ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Verley here. Coming up on the Country Hour, we'll have more from that Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into pig welfare, sitting for its second day in Melbourne today. We'll also check in on the Senate Committee scrutinising supermarket power and pricing. And farmer mental health is in the spotlight at an NFF wellbeing forum today. You'll hear from a South Gippsland dairy farmer who knows personally just how hard mental health challenges can be for people, particularly in rural communities. Get in touch on the text line 0467 842 722. The Senate Committee scrutinising supermarket pricing and market power has heard more stories of food producers being squeezed harder and harder by the major supermarkets. The committee is sitting in Melbourne today and has heard from groups including the National Farmers Federation and AusVeg. Have a listen here to AusVeg Chair Bill Bulmer addressing the committee this morning.
A grower rang me only 2 days ago who's supplied a certain retailer for 30 years. And they said, well, we'll renegotiate your contract at the start of June, as long as you take a $300 a tonne decrease on the product you've been supplying us for the last, 30 years. So, and he says, where am I going to go? I mean, they know where he's going to go, out of business.
So no price increase. He's actually got it. Everything's going up, but he's got to drop his price.
He's got to take a price decrease, yeah.
Because all the input costs are going up at the moment, Mr. Bulmer. Aren't they? Most or all of the input costs to running a farm are going up at the moment, like energy, fuel, like inflation's high.
Yep.
And then the big supermarket corporations are turning around and try to screw farmers down on price.
True.
Not trying to.
They are. Look, last question for me to you, Mr. Coonan, to the points you made in your opening remarks. So just so the committee's clear, in surveys you've done, over a third of people that you represent are seriously considering getting out of business, getting out of the film, out of the primary production business. Is that right?
Over a third and increasing.
Over a third and increasing. And part of the reason that that so many people are considering leaving the sector is that they can't get a decent price for their produce.
Correct. That is one part, and the other part is increased compliance costs and workforce issues, but certainly getting paid a fair and reasonable return to run viable, sustainable businesses is one of the key drivers that's leading to vegetable producers looking at alternative options.
And the major supermarket corporations, obviously, Coles and Woolworths, are playing a significant role in that lack of viability of those businesses.
The retail market channel takes over 50, close to 60% of our fresh produce. So, yes, they obviously play a major role in that.
That was AusVeg Chief Executive Michael Coote and earlier AusVeg Chair Bill Bulmer. Fred Harrison, the Chief Executive of the Ritchie's Group of IGA Supermarkets, also addressed the committee. Have a listen to what he had to say.
Independent retailers certainly support this inquiry because we know customers are concerned about the level of dominance in the supermarket sector. Customers know dominance leads to higher prices and less choice, and they are correct. Independent retailers share the concerns of suppliers that dominance in the market sector makes it very hard for them to access markets. I believe Australia's competition laws need to be strengthened, which is why my main message for the committee is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. The perfect being divestiture, the good being strengthening merger laws. IGA retailers have lodged 2 submissions to the mergers review, which, if implemented, would make it much harder for the chains to continue to grow unchecked. Currently, the competition laws stop virtually nothing. That's why we see the chains roll out new stores essentially unchecked by the ACCC. IGA retailers are seeking the following changes to merger laws which would make it much harder for the chains to roll out new stores at the exclusion of any other option. Firstly, the first change is to the test. No account is taken of the national market share when chains open new stores. The fact the chains combined have 65% plus market share is simply not considered in the competition test. To ignore the overall dominance of a chain when assessing the next creeping acquisition is to ignore the fact of dominance. A recent example of a chain opening a store in a market where they already have a store is Milton, Queensland. Coles purchased the Milton Village Shopping Centre 3 years ago, after which they lodged a development application to replace the IGA supermarket in the centre for a new, larger Coles store. The IGA store closed last month because Coles would not offer the IGA owner a new lease. The customers of the IGA store have expressed outrage online at the closure of the IGA, as there are two Coles supermarkets less than a five-minute drive from the Milton Village Shopping Centre. The Milton IGA customers are losing their last non-chain supermarket, and they know this means also they will also lose any chance of choice and competition into the future. As far as I am aware, the ACCC was not advised of this acquisition by Coles, nor their plan to close the last remaining competitor in the area. Stronger merger laws should ensure that what happened at Milton does not happen again. Imagine a world where consumers would get more new supermarket operators and more competition. Imagine a world where suppliers would get more routes to market as a new supermarket site got taken up by non-chain supermarkets.
That was Fred Harrison, the chief executive of the Ritchie's Group of IGA Supermarkets. He was speaking at the Senate inquiry on supermarket pricing sitting in Melbourne this morning. I'd be interested to hear from you your thoughts on what either Fred Harrison or representatives from AusVeg had to say at the committee this morning, or if you've had dealings with the major supermarkets, what your experiences have been. 0467 842 722 is the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, from that federal Senate inquiry to the Victorian Parliamentary inquiry into the pig industry that's revealed members of an animal activist group which breaks into abattoirs and piggeries to capture film have never been charged. The inquiry was called when Farm Transparency Project released footage of pigs being stunned with carbon dioxide. That's a legal practice, but activists say it's cruel. The state MPs on the committee were also shown some disturbing footage recently shot at a Victorian piggery. Emma Field reports.
Yesterday was the first of a two-day parliamentary hearing into pig welfare. And an hour into the hearing, the Farm Transparency Project aired footage they obtained by breaking into the Midland Bacon at Carrag Carrag. The cameras captured legal industry practices, including workers using blunt force to euthanise runt piglets, as well as clipping teeth and docking tails, and also vision of a man allegedly performing a sexual act against a pig at the facility. Under questioning by Nationals MP Gail Broad, Farm Transparency Project spokesperson Chris Delforce and Harley McDonald-Eckersall revealed they had never been charged for trespass or other offences when they'd broken into abattoirs or farms to secretly film.
I've read your submission and it says that I've visited 66 slaughterhouses and 109 pig farms across Australia. Most of these visits have been the result of trespass without the knowledge or consent of the owners of the facilities.
Yes.
So you are breaking the law?
Absolutely.
Right.
Full transparency, that's what we do. It's the only way that people will see inside these places, because these places are never going to open the doors for the public. The only reason we're having this inquiry, the only reason anyone knows anything about this industry is because people like us risk their lives and their freedom and their safety and their psychological well-being to break the law and go and get this footage and expose it. We think that the cruelty to that animal should be considered the worst crime than jumping a fence to film it.
We've received no charges for any of the footage that we've released.
Mr. Delforce, under questioning from Upper House MP Tom McIntosh, told the inquiry there's no humane way of slaughtering pigs in abattoirs, which includes using carbon dioxide to stun the pigs before they're killed.
The farmers who are putting in those efforts to improve their practices are doing so because they care about pigs, but ultimately welfare is incompatible with this industry. The two cannot go hand in hand, and I think those farmers ultimately are going to want to get out of that industry, and they need to be helped to do that. And at the end of the day, all these pigs, no matter how well they are treated on the farm, are ending up in slaughterhouses, and most of those are using these gas chambers, which are apparently the most humane method of doing it. And we've seen how very far from humane that is. There is no way to do this in a humane way. There's always fear and suffering and pain. And when we exposed those chambers last year, even farmers were coming out and saying, this is horrific, they don't want to support this anymore, but there's no alternatives. There is no alternative that's good.
Like, when you say you don't think there are more humane methods, is there a scale? Are there some that are doing better than others?
Well, we've investigated all the different types. So as well as the gas chambers, we've investigated electrical stunning, bolt gun stunning, and rifle stunning. And every time, it's pretty horrific. A lot of the time, the stunning fails. Animals are conscious or partly conscious when they're being killed. And there's a lot more rough handling involved in getting those animals to the point of being killed. Often it's done in front of each other, so they're able to see their friends or their siblings dying before them. So we haven't seen any way that is being done that's better or good, and the industry itself acknowledges that these other methods are even worse than gas chambers.
And while some abattoirs now have CCTV installed in their facilities, Ms. McDonald Eckersall from the Farm Transparency Project says it's often not monitored, so is not effective, and says regulator PrimeSafe needs to do better.
In the fact that we entered these facilities and installed cameras and weren't caught on camera shows how little they view this footage. We have been providing all of this slaughterhouse footage to PrimeSafe and to the kind of relevant other authorities in other states, and every time an investigation is opened, and a lot of the time some really severe breaches of animal welfare are found. The fact that this keeps on happening shows that this is a systemic issue.
Animal Alliance spokesperson Jed Goodfellow said regulators need to be more transparent.
There is no transparency around it. We don't know who's conducting inspections, how often those inspections are conducted, what the results of those inspections are. There is limited to no transparency around that compliance monitoring system. My understanding is that in Victoria, under the current Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, there is no power for engaging in unannounced inspections to conduct audits of facilities, whereas that power does exist in other states and territories. That would be certainly something we would encourage committee members to consider.
That was Animal Alliance spokesperson Jed Goodfellow ending that report from Emma Field. That inquiry is continuing today. There are industry groups such as Australian Pork Limited and processor JBS speaking at that hearing today, and our reporter Emma Field is tuned in to the hearing. We'll cross to her in the second half of the show and get the latest from her. Few texts coming through on supermarket pricing and supermarket power. Peter in the Northwest says, on supermarket prices, all ag producers are price takers, not price setters. I am a wheat farmer, and today's Farmgate wheat prices are less than what they were 25 years ago. Try to make ends meet on those returns, and it's difficult. Thanks, Peter. This person says, food is an essential service. There must be a base price and a government retainer. We must make our own food for food security. And on the matter of the big two supermarkets, this texter says, government inquiries are a waste of time and energy. Governments are only interested in their own agendas. Only consumers can change the culture by changing their buying habits. Thanks for your thoughts. 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
More than 20 farmers are on BlazeAid's waitlist for help repairing fences damaged in the February 13 storm that smashed South Gippsland. Peter Jones is helping coordinate activities in Merbau North, where the organisation is working to establish a base camp. He says about 25 volunteers are on standby to help out, but they're waiting on council approval to go ahead.
They want to get community sports up and running. And if we've got a camp there, they don't want it to interfere with community activities, which I can sort of understand, but we can be on the side of that because most of the people that volunteers will be out all day anyway. The main reason for any Blaze Aid camp is to help the farmers get their fences back in order, because a lot of them need the fences back up because they've got stock that could wander. And I've probably had to put them in other paddocks that aren't really suitable for the stock at the moment. So we normally do exterior fences at the start so that they can start using the fields that they have in the correct order. So the main reason is to help the farmers just get something done.
So you're pretty keen for council to help find you a site pretty soon?
Absolutely, absolutely. We can't move until we get the council to give us a ground that we can actually work with.
And so you're looking for volunteers?
Absolutely. We'll be doing a volunteer call out on Facebook and local radio, but we can't once again call for volunteers until we have somewhere to go, because if they take another 2 or 3 weeks, they will have called off by then. So it all comes back to the same thing. If we can just have a place to call home. We're really keen to get going. We have a team. We have all of the gear ready to go. That's all over in Morwell at the moment. It's only a matter of dragging the trailers over to Mervu North or wherever we can go. And I've got the team we can get up and running within 3 days.
That was Blaze Aid coordinator Peter Jones speaking with Anne Simmons. In a statement, the South Gippsland Shire Council said, "Council has had numerous conversations with Blaze Aid, as have other Gippsland councils, in an effort to find a suitable location. A central location is preferable, as a number of local government areas were significantly impacted by the storm event." The statement also says, "Engaging Blaze Aid does not just require available space. There are other requirements that need to be considered, such as bathrooms and meal areas. The Mervu North Recreation Reserve is not a suitable option. It was used for around 3 weeks as a storm response staging area and has been recently reopened for sporting activity by the Mervu North Recreation Reserve Committee." Quickly on the text line, this person says, "G'day, fruit farmer here. Average 70 hours of work per week with no income. It's getting harder to keep doing this. At the moment, I feel I'm only doing it to keep employing my crew and feed the Australian public." Well, the public who actually care about farmers, that is, says Bo. Thanks, Bo. 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
The Warracknabeel community in Western Victoria remains in mourning after 3 farmer fatalities in just 3 weeks. Late last month, 91-year-old Merv Thomas died in a quad bike accident. Earlier in the month, Mick Morecambe died when he was struck by a falling auger, and Mark Hubner was killed in a tractor rollover. I spoke with local farmer Ross Johns, who knew all 3 men, about the tragic accidents and about what needs to change to keep farmers safe on farms.
Well, we've had 3 tragic fatalities in farm-related accidents in 3 weeks. All 3 people I knew, all 3 people have some place in my heart.
And Ross, 1 fatality on its own is terrible enough, but to have 3 in 3 weeks, all in the one community, that's shocking.
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely tragic. And in an absolute bigger sense, agriculture has to become a safer place, and we all have a responsibility to make it a safer place.
How is the community travelling to have lost these 3 highly respected and loved people?
Well, I can tell you what, there's a lot of pain, a lot of anguish, and a lot of angst. But let's not make any of these deaths in vain. Let's create something positive for the future. And we've got to instigate change amongst every worker, every person, every farm owner in Australia.
So what does need to change? How do we stop farmers dying when they're going about their daily work?
Well, first of all, I think we should recognise that agriculture is extremely risky. There's 10 times the fatality rate in agriculture than there is in the rest of the Australian workforce. that statistic is a fact. We've got to bring our fatality rate, our injury rate, down to at least industry averages across the board. And that's going to take recognition from every single person in agriculture and some change in the way we operate.
And as you've addressed there, there are just those inherent dangers, aren't there, in that normal day-to-day work, whether it's working with livestock, operating heavy machinery, whatever it might be. There are so many risks that you need to try and mitigate.
Absolutely. Agriculture is a risky business, and I think we've just highlighted that as the fact with the broad-based numbers. What we can do is we can recognise it as a risk, and we can adjust our activity and our behaviour to reduce that risk meaningfully.
And what are, in practical terms, Ross, what do you see as those adjustments to reduce those risks?
Well, the first thing that agriculture needs to do is recognise that it's a problem. And I think those statistics of 10 times the rate, fatality rate of the broader community certainly highlights that. So if we all recognise it as a problem, then what we need to do is empower people to make a change, which is provide them with information that can make a meaningful difference to the risks, and then to change the culture, practices and procedures of agriculture. Every individual farm, every individual worker must change the way we approach the risks and treat these risks just as another business process. And then we must be able to measure the difference. So over time, we must be able to have a measurable difference in fatality rate, in injury rate, in hospitalisation.
There is that phrase, Ross, some people just describe it as a dangerous phrase, that this is the way we've always done things. So people might say, we've always done things this way, it's always been fine, so why do we need to change? Why do we have to add in extra layers of safety? But what would you say to that?
Well, if we always do what we've always done, we will always get what we've always got. And I think there's widespread acceptance that the fatality rate in agriculture is way too high. The people we lose out of agriculture, the impact it has on communities and families is just tragic. If anyone in agriculture thinks they don't have to change, I think we send the WorkSafe investigator and charge them $100,000 on their naivety.
And speaking of WorkSafe, I did speak with Narelle Beer from WorkSafe last week, who grew up on a farm herself and I think has an understanding of agriculture. And I guess she made the point that perhaps in a typical business, when you're considering safety and risk, you've got a team around you to talk through things, but a farmer might be in isolation or might only have one or two other people there and don't necessarily have that sort of safety brainstorming that can be done.
Well, that is probably true. A lot of farmers work alone. We're in isolated locations. It doesn't mean we should take risk. In fact, it probably means we should be extra cautious not to take those risks associated with quad bikes, which are horrendous, with tractors, which are horrendous. In fact, any statistics around farm safety are horrendous, and we should be very mindful of that in remote work environments in particular.
Are the rep groups, the peak bodies, the advocacy groups, are they doing enough, do you think, to promote and communicate farm safety?
Well, I think what happens is because farm deaths and fatalities are so tragic, everyone sweeps it under the carpet in the hope not to further exacerbate the pain on the family and the communities. But in fact, what we need to do is collect learnings from each of these tragic circumstances and try and bring about change for the future.
Because in the case of these tragic fatalities, you don't want to, of course, be attributing blame and saying, well, if this had been done differently, this person would still be with us?
Well, I think the information from each and every one of these, not just a fatality, but a hospitalisation or an injury or a near miss, is all valuable information for any farm manager to actually implement safe work practices. So somehow or other, we've got to collate all this information. And it might be painful for people. It's damn painful for me to think about what we could have done to prevent these deaths. But we've still got to present it to every manager on every farm in Australia.
You were talking to me about the honour wall at Broken Hill with the names of people killed in the mine there and thinking that perhaps something like that for agriculture and farming could be useful.
Well, I certainly think remembering the past is an important way to to reduce the risk in the future. And maybe we should have a on a wall in Canberra, just like our war memorials, remembering the farmers who died in the pursuit of agriculture.
So just finally, Ross, where do we go from here?
Right, well, I think the key points, 93% of farm fatalities in Australia are male. Absolutely imperative. If you're male working on a farm, be very careful. If you're over 60 and male working on a farm, you're in the absolute tragic number zone. Be doubly careful, and that means be aware of every single circumstance that you're involved in. Female brains are much better adjusted to risk, and I think we should listen very much to the females of the agricultural community. So safety, safety and safety. There's no use making money and injuring people in the process. That's just ludicrous.
That was Ross Johns speaking about the need for greater farm safety after the tragic deaths of three Warrantabil farmers in the space of just 3 weeks. We'll get to rural news shortly, but on the text line, this text are actually linking that story with the story about supermarket pricing. They say, people say to struggling farmers, work harder at what you can control. The first thing that suffers when margins narrow is safety, so pay us a fair price. Macca says, Angus, I feel everyone who owns a slaughterhouse will be checking their buildings for hidden cameras from now on every day, and I don't blame them. And this texter says, Warwick's actually off for the week. He'll be back Monday. This person says, please stop giving these crazies from these so-called animal welfare groups any attention or any airtime. They don't want any animals for food production. 0467 842 722 is the text line. Keep reading your texts, but right now let's get to rural news, and today that's with Jane McNaughton.
Thanks, Angus. A fruit grower in Victoria is calling for immediate action on supermarket pricing, saying a number of family-run farms are at risk of closing over the next year, which would lead to higher prices for shoppers. Michael Crescenta from Fruit Growers Victoria says suppliers like him are at the mercy of supermarkets and end up pricing their goods below production costs. He'll give evidence at today's hearing of a Senate inquiry into the major supermarkets, which is sitting in Melbourne, and says the biggest issue he'll be raising is the lack of transparency.
So our suppliers go off the word of the buyers of what the market price in their eyes is. I often see the unnecessary value taken away from our growers just to make sure that the retailers get the fruit as cheap as possible and then can make as much profit as they can on top of that.
Chinese authorities have released an interim decision that high tariffs on Australian wine are no longer necessary. The tariffs of 220% were put in place in 2020 on bottled wine and saw the value of Australian wine drop from more than $1 billion at its peak to about $10 million last year. East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood has more.
The tariffs were imposed in 2020 and have crippled the Australian wine industry. Worth $1.2 billion at its height, the market's value was down to just $10 million last year. But Beijing has released an interim decision that duties on bottled wine are no longer needed. Stakeholders are now able to make submissions, with a final decision anticipated by the end of the month. The Foreign Minister Penny Wong said Canberra would continue to press for remaining trade barriers to be lifted. Australian lobster and some red meat are still subject to Chinese trade bans.
Australian Grape and Wine Chief Executive Lee McLean says it's a step in the right direction.
It is welcome. Of course, we would welcome the opportunity to export to China again. We know Chinese consumers enjoy Australian wine. That hasn't changed over the last couple of years. But as your listeners will well know, there is a significant amount of stock in this system in terms of red wine in particular in Australia and in areas like the Riverland. That's going to take some time to work through. And we also know that the China market itself has changed considerably over the last couple of years. We've lost a little bit of market share to other producer nations, but people are also drinking a little bit less by volume in China too. So the likelihood of us going back to that $1.2 billion figure is very slim, but it will still be an important market to us if that final determination goes our way.
And a global financial services company says recent price volatility in the cattle market should have producers thinking about and getting their head around cattle swaps as a price risk management tool. A cattle swap is a financial derivative where producers are able to lock in a future price for their cattle. StoneX initially launched its Australian feeder cattle swap in February 2022, and the first trade took place in October the same year. But but it's been pretty quiet since then. So while some analysts agree future markets is a good idea, it seems there's still some work to be done before the industry jumps on board. Ripley Atkinson is the Australian Livestock and Commodities Manager with StoneX.
The appetite's there. It's now about education and making people feel comfortable with using something that for most of the industry is foreign.
So how does it work?
So the way it works is StoneX connects the buyer and seller who operate anonymously. They won't know one another. But if we look at it from a producer perspective, they would use the swap to manage risk on a forward price basis anywhere out to 12 months in advance for the sale of cattle that they intend to sell within the next 12 months. The idea is to lock in the margin between basically the point in time of those cattle being on farm now and when you intend to sell them. So the weight gain between where we are right now and when those cattle are due to be sold and the weight gain that generates income, the swap looks to lock in that margin or that amount of money.
How is it priced?
It's priced against the Argus Media Northern Feeder Index. Argus Media is a global price reporting company. This Argus Feeder Steer Index is priced every Thursday from over sort of 30 to 40 companies and all sort of parts of the supply chain.
And that's today's Rural News, Angus.
Thanks, Jane. Jane McNaughton there with Rural News. Let's head to the Bureau now. Senior forecaster Michael Efron joins us. Afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Angus.
Michael, it was pleasant this morning to wake up early, step outside and have a bit of a brisk chill in the air rather than the sticky overnight weather that we have been having.
Exactly right. We did see a southerly push through yesterday morning. Not through all of the state, however, still quite warm through the far northwest today. But further south, we do have quite extensive cloud cover that's associated with tropical moisture moving south from WA across the Bight and then over Victoria. So we are seeing some patchy rain near and south of the Dividing Range, but in terms of rainfall totals, it generally has been less than 5 millimetres, and I don't think we'll see huge totals through the rest of the day, but a little bit damp near and south of the Divide. But in the far northwest, with relatively clear skies, we are still looking at a top of 38 degrees at Mildura, 35 for Swan Hill, 27 at Horsham, 31 for Echuca, Bendigo up to 27, Albury-Wodonga 33, Wangaratta 31, and then further south, Hamilton and Warrnambool only 18, Sale 25, Bairnsdale 25 as well. So quite a contrast in temperatures today due to that cloud cover. But as we head into Thursday, we will see that southerly pushing further north and the cloud cover pushing further north as well. So we're not looking at as hot a day in the far northwest. So Mildura on Thursday expecting 31, Swan Hill 28, Echuca 26, Wangaratta 29, Hamilton and Warrnambool 21, Ballarat 20, Sale 23, Bairnsdale 22. And again, we will see that patchy rain, but it will extend a little bit further north compared to today. But once again, totals are generally under 5 millimetres. There is a slight chance of a thunderstorm over the far eastern, northeastern ranges. During the afternoon, we could see some slightly higher totals out of that, but not a widespread heavy rainfall event despite the really extensive cloud cover. But as we head into Friday, we do see the next high moving towards Tasmania, so the winds will turn a bit warmer easterly. We will see temperatures in the south pushing back into the mid-20s across the north, generally mid to high 20s, even low 30s, and a mostly dry day as well, apart from some isolated showers over Gippsland in that easterly airstream. And then the weekend is looking warmer again with the winds turning northeasterly. We're looking at pretty settled weather both Saturday and Sunday, apart from the chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm through the north and northwest. Again, not looking at huge totals out of that, but a little bit unsettled in the north across the weekend. And those temperatures pushing into the low 30s in the north, mid to high 20s in the south. And then into next week, Monday looks pretty settled with northerly winds, temperatures in the high 20s or low 30s, mostly sunny day. And then on Tuesday, it looks like we do see a change moving in to the west of the state late in the day. So ahead of that, we'll have northerly winds in quite warm conditions as well, temperatures in the low to mid-30s in the north, high 20s or low 30s in the south as well, but those showers extending from the west later. So northerlies will shift cooler southwesterly. But at this stage, it doesn't look like a significant rainfall event, but still a fair way to go before that change arrives. But overall, a little bit of everything, but not necessarily any significant rainfall.
Okay, Michael, so that that run of dry weather, a lot of parts it hasn't rained sort of since about mid to late January, it sounds like that'll, apart from a few mil here or there, it sounds like that's going to continue.
That's right, yeah. There's nothing in these systems to indicate, the sort of 20 to 40 millimetres that would be nice at this time of year, especially given how dry it has been recently.
Rightio. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Angus.
Michael Efron there with what's happening and what's coming up weather-wise. Well, a second day of hearings is taking place in Victoria's Parliament today, where a committee is looking into pig welfare in the state. We heard yesterday about secretly filmed footage by animal activists showing pigs in a Victorian piggery being killed via blunt force trauma, and also a piggery employee allegedly committing an act of bestiality against a pig. Today, pig industry representatives were appearing at the hearing. Emma Field was there. She joins us now. Afternoon, Emma.
G'day, Angus.
Talk us through what's happened at the hearing so far today.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the pig industry bodies were all up at the hearing today as witnesses. So we had Australian Pork Limited, the Australian Meat Industry Council, which is AMIC representing the processors. And just before we came on air, there were two pig farmers, Victorian pig farmers, speaking. That was Tim Kingmar and David Wright. So they are the Victorian Farmers Federation. I know David Maher's the president of that pig council, and Tim is the ex-president. I only managed to listen to a really small part of what they said, but here's a question by MP Renee Heath about the footage that was released by animal activists and shown on ABC 730. And just a warning, some of this is pretty distressing.
This, I guess, one of the things that has been spoken about in the media, particularly in the last few days, is there was obviously some pretty disgusting imagery of somebody in a pig farm performing a sexual act with a pig. If that was to happen in your farm, what would your response be to that?
We would obviously, from my point of view, we'd obviously bring in the appropriate authorities and go down the path that we need to. We'd make sure the person...
Police, for instance?
Well, absolutely, it would be the police. We would, we would then make sure that the person involved was getting the help they needed as well. Our dismissal would be somewhere down the line once we work through the process with the relative authorities, because nobody can condone that style of behaviour at all.
Yeah, thank you.
Couldn't condone it. I don't know of it. I've never heard of it happening, and it's not something I'd ever thought, and
it's not something you ever thought. Like, you couldn't imagine that.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's like you'd think that in any workplace.
Yes.
And it's one of those ones. So I do 100% agree with Dave that it'd just be, it's a police matter. Deal with it. Obviously, that footage, I don't know when the footage was taken, but how ironic that it got delivered on the night before this inquiry. Mm. If I saw it happen, I'd deal with it right then and there.
Tim Kingmar, their Victorian farmer, speaking at the inquiry into pig welfare in Victoria's Parliament House taking place today. Before that, David Wright answered that question. And they did clarify later in the hearing that the footage that was taken that they were referring to was given to police straight away.
Yeah, I was about to ask about that point, Emma, because that's often a point of contention, isn't it? That people accuse these animal rights groups of sort of building up a war chest of footage rather than acting on it immediately.
Yeah, and we will hear a grab later on about that. It's actually quite interesting how some of the pig farmers or people affected have been dealing with activists coming onto their property. But let's just hear first of all from Australian Pork Limited, their CEO Margot Andre. She also addressed the footage that was released by the animal activists and some of the claims that they made yesterday.
Euthanizing pigs happens on farms. It's undertaken to alleviate the suffering of an animal. Any method of euthanasia must be instantaneous, effective, and humane. Artificial insemination has been instrumental for facilitating global improvements in fertility and herd health. It mimics a natural process and helps reduce the spread of disease. To compare artificial insemination to bestiality is cruel and offensive. And at its core, our industry is about providing food to Australians.
Margot Andre there, who's the Chief Executive of Australian Pork Limited. There was obviously a lot of discussion about the impact of activists trespassing on farms, the impact on the mental health to farmers, but also they talked a lot about biosecurity and that being a thing that's really threatened when this happens. Let's hear from Dawson Bradford. He's a WA pig farmer and also an APL board member.
Every pig farm, every APIC accredited pig farm has a biosecurity plan. So that's part of the part of our APIC program. So it, as Margot said, it's paramount to our industry. We've got exclusion, fencing, shower in, shower out, disinfecting of trucks. A lot of companies don't share trucks for cross-contamination. Disease, biosecurity is paramount to our industry. And trespass is one of our biggest weaknesses in terms of breakdown.
Thank you. Are you aware of biosecurity breaches as a result of trespassing? And did they result in animal deaths, if you are aware?
Is that sometimes the footage is provided more than 3 months after the break-ins actually occurred. Mm-hmm. But what we've found is that farms who have been broken into or repeatedly broken into are then actually able to track where they know they've been broken into. They can keep a really close eye on and be aware of potential biosecurity risks on farm. Where they find out they've been broken into, we've had producers in New South Wales and Victoria who've been able to go and look at the metadata of the photos and actually demonstrate that the activists have gone from one farm to another within a very short succession. And they've actually been able to then look at their own health records and their biosecurity records and go, oh, now we know where that particular disease that involved a lot of care and additional requirements, with additional work with the vets to manage, now we know where that disease came from. So, yes, they have actually had an animal health impact because of the way that they operate.
That was Policy and Industry Relations Manager with Australian Pork Limited, Tanya Pittard, answering that question from Upper House MP Renee Heath in this morning's hearings.
And, Emma, of course, we've had this week that the Meat Industry Council announced that for the meat processors falling under its code, video surveillance will become mandatory by 2026. Has that come up, the discussion of video surveillance or CCTV in abattoirs or piggeries?
Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a few questions around that. So we did have, I'm just trying to find the name, Timothy Ryan from the Australian Meat Industry Council appearing on behalf of the industry and the processors. And they said one of the reasons actually they've introduced CCTV is there's not a national minimum animal welfare standard across Australia. So they've actually had to go ahead and develop their own certification systems. And part of that now, obviously, is they're requiring anyone that signs up to that, which is they reckon about 80% of the industry, will install video surveillance systems in their facilities by 2026. Now, there was some questions around that, you know, that people wanted to know where will this footage go. So we'll play a grab from the hearing where they sort of talk about that.
We're going to work through a process. So so we'll take it through an expert review process to bring in the right people, bring in the right input from industry, but also critically welfare groups and regulators to make sure what we design is fit for purpose. For those plants certified under this program, it would be available for the regulator or in the case where it's part of an AusMeat audit, they'd also be looking at this too. So, but it wouldn't be going beyond that to a public viewing or another body external to the company.
Why should we even entertain the idea that CCTV footage obtained for practical purposes in a workplace should be available to the general public?
Yeah. I don't think the general public want to see it. They understand that an animal has to be processed. They want to be assured that it's done humanely and respectfully. They want to know that the regulator has sufficient oversight, but they don't want to see the process necessarily. And that's what we hear from consumer research. The groups that do want to see it is, I suppose, the ones that we heard from yesterday.
That was Australian Meat Industry Council's Tim Ryan there answering a question from Bev MacArthur. And this afternoon, we've got a couple more people appearing. We've got, obviously, I think the farmers that I was speaking about are still speaking as we speak now. And we have Processor JBS coming up and also Victorian Farmers Federation.
Thanks very much for bringing us those details, Emma.
No problem.
Emma Field there, who's been at that Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Pig Welfare, sitting in Melbourne, well, yesterday, and then back again today.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Farmer mental health will be in the spotlight today at a wellbeing forum in Melbourne. South Gippsland dairy farmer Aaron Thomas knows how hard the journey to health can be for people in rural communities. He spoke with Fiona Broom.
It's about having a discussion around mental health in agriculture. I was very fortunate enough to be asked to come along to speak about my experiences with mental health and the work that I do in the ag industry, especially dairy. In 2016, I had a full mental breakdown and embarked on, you know, getting my life back together and decided that I was going to actually make my story public and share it with hope that, you know, it could give someone the support or someone the confidence to seek help and, you know, turn their life around like I have.
What was it that helped you to get through that period in your life and to come out the other side?
Amazing support from our family, friends and my industry that, you know, just rallied behind me and never gave in. And, you know, it wasn't easy. There was some good days and there was some bad days and, you know, everyone just stuck by me and gave me the time and the space that I needed to beat this disease or, well, learn the tools to manage it.
So 2016, were there some factors, particularly within the dairy industry at that stage, that might have contributed to your mental health at the time?
Oh, look, there was lots of factors. My relationship broke down. Obviously, there was the milk price collapse. We were in drought. Yeah, there was lots of – it just all came to a head and it just happened to be around that time when there was, you know, lots going on in the industry, especially, you know, around the milk price collapse and where I was farming, where, you know, in a very unseasonal dry pattern, which, you know, obviously put a lot of pressure on the farm business, a lot of pressure on me. And yeah, it just all came to a head.
The health sector has been trying to encourage agricultural communities and especially men to think about their mental health and remove some of the stigma around it. Do you think things are changing?
I believe there is a little bit more awareness, but we're still losing people, especially males. People are still taking their lives and going through a hard time. So I don't think we've achieved what we need to achieve. People are being a little bit more open from what I can gather, but yeah, we've still got a long way to go, a long way.
What would you like to see happen in this space? What do you think agricultural communities need in terms of support?
Probably the first thing that comes to my mind is access to getting that help. You know, some people aren't obviously as financial as what I was. So I actually went through private sectors. So I was going to, you know, private GPs, private counsellors, private drug and alcohol therapy, you know, because I didn't have time to wait. I didn't have time to wait 2-3 weeks for an appointment to go through the public system. So that needs to change. We need to have accessibility, more accessibility for people who may not be able to foot the bill, especially in small regional communities. You know, you might know the person at the clinic, or you might know the receptionist, or you might even know the GP. And I think that can make it a lot difficult for people to take that initial first step. I know I actually went out of my area to seek that first initial help because of that fear of, oh, who do I know? I might know someone who works there. Oh, no. So I actually went outside of my area to get that help.
How did you actually recognise that you needed help? Do you think it's often the case that people sort of don't realise quite how bad of a situation they're in until it really becomes, you know, extremely bad?
Yeah, look, I knew I was bad. You know, you don't get much worse than trying to attempt to take your life twice. So I knew I was in big trouble, and eventually I think what happened is family and friends just almost, you know, intervened. I had no choice. I completely collapsed, and there was nothing left. I couldn't even function.
That sounds really, really confronting, Aaron.
Yeah, it was very confronting for people in my life. It's been a hell of a journey, but it's been also, for me, it's been very rewarding as well, because I've got my life back and it saved my life.
What would your message be to perhaps other people who might find themselves in a similar situation?
Please just find someone to go and talk to, whether it's just a friend, a family member, or you go and make an appointment to see your GP or a counsellor. But I just urge anybody, just please go and find someone to speak to. Doesn't even have to be a professional. Sometimes you know just someone in your life that you can get that initial burden off your chest, and then, you know, and then you start to look for a way forward to, you know, get things in place. But yeah, that would be my advice, is just please find someone to speak to. You don't have to go through this on your own.
That was Gippsland dairy farmer and mental health advocate Aaron Thomas speaking with our reporter Fiona Broome very openly and generously. And if you or someone you know does need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Markets now, starting today at Leongather Cattle with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day Angus, there were 250 fewer at 1850, with the usual blind group operating selectively in a cheaper market. Quality fell away quickly from the lead pens, with many cattle showing the summer. The best trade lots eased slightly. Grown steers and bullocks lost 5 cents. Manufacturing steers gave back 5 to 15. Heavy beef cows eased 15 cents, while light dairy lots held firm and heavy bulls improved slightly. Vealers sold from 223 to 387. Yearling trade steers 280 to 340. The heifer portion 200 to 305. Grown steers 270 to 299. Bullocks 275 to 306. Heavy Friesian steers 203 to 245. Crossbreds 210 to 294. Most light and medium weight cows 120 to 210. Heavyweights 172 to 235. Heavy bulls 222 to 288. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Hamilton Lambs now with Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Angus. Numbers rose to 17,500 lambs at Hamilton, an increase of 7,000 head. Quality overall was very good. Most of the processors were present and nearly all fully active. The market started very sluggish, but as it progressed, the market picked up full momentum, with the most sought-after lambs being the light trade weight lambs, 17 to 23 kilos, and these were dearer by $5 per head. The 24 to 26s were slightly softer, with the heavier lambs to be $10 per head cheaper. Depending on quality, lambs back to the paddock remaining firm to 10 dearer. The best heavy lambs made to 176. Most lambs to the trade realising between 650 and 740 cents over most categories. And less for the heavyweights. These were averaging around 580 cents. Light 12 to 16 kg lambs making from 80 to 127, 18 to 22 kgs 124 to 162, and the 22 to 26 kg lambs 155 to 175. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Horsham now with Graham Pymer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply increased a little to 7,250, and there was an increase to 1,050 sheep. Quality was mixed with the usual buying group operating in a firm Badura market and places. Several pens of nice quality heavy lambs improved $5 a head. Medium and heavy trade weight sold from 128 to 153, and the heavier weight sold from 186 to 205. Restockers paid from 115 to 145, 25 to 39 for lighter weights, and 37 to 42 for unshorn lambs. Approximately 1,000 Merino lambs were penned, selling from 73 to 122 to average 500 cents. Some lighter weights sold to 101 to average close to 600 cents. Heavy hoggets made to 168. The sheep offering sold to keener demand to be $5 to $10 head up last week. Merino ewes made to 87, heavy crossbred ewes to 95. The light trade lambs sold from 106 to 127, averaging 580 cents. Medium trade weight sold 128 to 144 to average 560. Export weight lamb sold from 166 to 182 to average 610. Extra heavyweight sold from 186 to 205. They've averaged 585. Medium weight sheep sold from 40 to 78 with merino mutton averaging 240. And Graham Pymer at Horsham from LA.
Thanks, Graham. Almost out of time. Quickly on the text line, a sheep producer has said, animal rights activists may be judged poorly by farmers, but at the end of the day, we need to be held accountable for animal welfare. We want the world to know that we care for and humanely euthanise our animals. Thanks for all of your contributions today. News time now. It's 1 o'clock.